eKatra Podcast Conversations, for the curious essential knowledge, simplified. Your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of eKatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. You know, if you've ever been in a huge museum, maybe a centuries-old church, and you're just looking at wall after wall of religious art.
All the crucifixes, the Madonnas, the saints.
Exactly. And it all starts to blur, right? Like 2,000 years of this stuff, it can feel, well, overwhelming. If that sounds familiar, this deep dive is definitely for you.
Yeah, we're kind of stepping back from the usual timeline chaos today. We're going to use a different lens, a really interesting filter, actually, from Beth Williamson's book, Christian Art, a very short introduction.
Because most people, I think, they see Christian art and immediately try to slot it into styles. You know, is it Romanesque, Gothic, Baroque?
Yeah.
And it's a lot.
It is. It's exhausting, and sometimes it doesn't even help that much. Williamson looks at this vast amount of art and asks something, well, simpler, but actually much deeper.
Right. She flips the question. Instead of what style is this, she asks, what actually makes any piece of art Christian in the first place?
Mm-hmm. And her big argument, the thing that ties it all together, she says it's the function. It's not about how it looks necessarily, but what it does, how it's used by Christians, by the community.
And thinking about it that way.
Yeah.
It's like an instant shortcut, isn't it? It frees you up from memorizing all the dates and styles.
It really does. It gives you this one tool you can use to look at, I don't know, paintings in the catacombs and modern installations and see a connection.
Okay, so let's talk about the person behind this idea, Beth Williamson. Who is she?
Well, she's a fantastic guide for this. She's a highly respected academic professor of medieval art at the University of Bristol. Very scholarly, but she writes with this amazing clarity.
And her focus is the medieval period, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which seems really important for this functional approach.
Absolutely key. She digs into the later Middle Ages, and she's really interested in how art, religion, and the sensory experience all intersect.
Sensory experience, so not just looking at it.
Exactly. Not just seeing it, but how it was felt, how things like light and color and just the emotional punch of a piece created this whole experience for the person praying or worshiping.
Ah, okay. So she's interested in the lived reality.
That's it. The lived reality of faith and how these objects help shape that. The medieval era, which she knows inside out, was really the peak of functional art. This was way before art for art's sake became a big thing.
So art had a job to do.
It absolutely did. It was a tool woven into religious life, into devotion. She wants to understand how these objects were meant to make people feel and maybe even act.
That frames the book perfectly. It's less a history book, more a guide to asking better questions.
Yeah. Moving beyond who made this.
To what was this actually for? How did it work? You know, in a church service or maybe when someone was praying alone.
Exactly. And she takes us on this really logical journey through the book. Starts with the biggest hurdle, really.
Which?
Legitimacy. How does a religion that comes from Judaism, which was famously wary of images, you know, the whole graven images thing, how does it end up with so much art? That's the idolatry problem.
Okay, makes sense. Get that sorted first.
Right. Then, once that's established, she explores the practical jobs art had, like art as a teaching tool, the classic Bible of the illiterate.
Visual stories for people who couldn't read.
Mm-hmm. Then you see art right in the middle of the main event, the liturgy, things like altarpieces, chalices. They weren't just props. They were active parts of the ritual.
Huh. Active parts. Interesting.
Yeah. And she covers the emotional angle, too, this thing called affective piety, personal devotion, using art to really feel Christ's suffering, for example.
You can't talk about images without
the Reformation. Absolutely. That huge break, the iconoclasm, smashing statues, breaking windows, a massive challenge.
And then she brings it up to today.
Yep. How does Christian art work now? In our world, which is just flooded with images and often pretty secular, it's a great structure, and it all hangs on that one idea of function.
Okay, let's dive into some of those functions then.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the theology first. Like a Roman catacomb painting looks nothing like a huge Gothic cathedral.
Not at all.
But Williamson says they're doing the same basic job.
Fundamentally, yes. Helping Christians be Christians. But as you hinted, getting images accepted wasn't straightforward. There was a huge fight.
The iconoclast controversy.
Right.
In the Byzantine Empire, like 8th, 9th centuries.
Yeah.
What was the core issue Williamson highlights there?
Well, it was a battle between the iconoclasts, the image breakers, who basically saw any religious image as idolatry breaking the commandments.
Okay.
And the iconodules, the image venerators, people like St. John of Damascus, who came up with this really sophisticated defense of images. And spoiler alert, they won. That's why the church kept using images.
And the key idea they used, which I think people still get confused about, is that the icon isn't an idol. You don't worship the painting itself.
Exactly. That's the crucial distinction. They argued the icon is like a sacred threshold, a conduit. The famous analogy is a window.
A window to heaven, sort of.
Kind of. A window to the divine person it represents. So it's meant to be venerated, shown respect, honored, because that honor is believed to pass through the object to the actual holy figure. It's a tool for encounter, not the thing you worship itself.
That clarity is so important. Okay, so if we accept images theologically, let's talk about the teaching part. What's a great example of art as pure education back then?
Well, narrative art was huge because most people couldn't read. Visual theology, basically. Williamson points to Giotto's frescoes in the Scrovegni Chapel in Padua. It's a perfect case study.
Ah, Giotto. He was amazing at storytelling, wasn't he?
Incredible. He laid out the stories, Mary's life, Jesus's life, in this really clear sequence, used gestures people would recognize, real human emotion. It made these complex Bible stories feel relatable, memorable.
So he was literally shaping how people understood their faith just through pictures.
Pretty much. Building collective memory. Which flows nicely into the next big function, art in ritual. Chapter 4 looks at art within the liturgy.
Like the altarpiece you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. The altarpiece isn't just, you know, a pretty background painting.
It's activated by the ritual.
That's the idea. It's the backdrop, often dramatic, for the absolute core moment of the Catholic Mass, the consecration of the bread and wine, the Eucharist. The pictures on it, often the crucifixion or saints, they visually reinforce the sacred act happening right in front of it. Art and ritual working together.
A functional unit. I like that. Okay, what about the emotional side? Affective piety.
Yeah, chapter 5. This became really big in the later Middle Ages. Art's job here was to stir up really intense personal feelings, especially empathy with Christ's suffering, making it feel real.
Man, the example for this has to be the Eisenheim altarpiece by Grunewald, right? I mean, just photos of it are intense.
Oh, incredibly intense. And its function was hyper-specific. It was made for a hospital run by monks who treated people with horrific skin diseases like ergotism, often leading to amputations.
So the painting itself,
right?
It's gruesome. Christ's body's covered in sores, torn.
Exactly. Horrifically graphic. But the function was pastoral. It was meant to resonate directly with the patient's own physical agony to say, look, God understands your suffering. He went through it too. It was offering solidarity, comfort, spiritual medicine in a way.
Wow. Artist therapy. That's powerful. And the chapter also mentions reliquaries, right? Those containers for saints' relics.
Yes. Another type of highly functional object believed to channel divine power through the material remains they held.
But all this focus on physical objects, images, relics.
Yeah.
That leads straight to the big conflict.
Chapter 6, the Protestant Reformation. Reformers like Calvin saw all this as, well, dangerous. Distraction, superstition, or worse, outright idolatry focusing on the thing instead of God.
That leads to iconoclasm, smashing statues, breaking stained glass.
Yeah, and it wasn't just random vandalism. It was theology in action, a deliberate rejection of the image as a necessary go-between. Faith needed to shift, they argued, from the visual object to the word scripture, preaching, sola scriptura.
That's a massive shift. So jumping ahead, chapter 7 brings us to modern times. What happens when the church isn't the main patron anymore and artists are all about self-expression?
It's a challenge, right? How does sacred art stay functional? How does it avoid just becoming sentimental decoration or kind of cheesy kitsch?
Does she give examples of modern functional art?
She does. Mark Wallinger's Ecce Homo is a good one. It's this life-sized, quite vulnerable statue of Jesus shown after being beaten. And Wallinger put it on a plinth in Trafalgar Square, a totally secular public space in London.
So its function is what? To confront people?
Pretty much. To challenge the modern passerby who might be totally indifferent to actually reckon with this figure outside of a church setting makes you stop and think.
And the final chapter looks globally.
Yeah. Chapter 8 explores how the tradition adapts culturally. Enculturation, that's the term. Seeing how Christian themes get expressed through local artistic styles in Africa, Asia, Latin America, it shows the core function can work anywhere, keeping the tradition alive and relevant.
Okay, that's a whirlwind tour.
Oh.
So let's distill this. What are the main takeaways, the big ideas Williamson gives us to work with?
Well, takeaway number one has to be the core concept itself, function over form. It's just such a powerful way to think about it. lets you connect the dots across centuries and styles based on what the art did.
Okay, takeaway two.
I'd say the power and peril of the image. This tension isn't just ancient history from the iconoclast days, it's ongoing. Images can be amazing bridges to the divine, but there's always that risk they become the destination itself, you know, the idol.
Right, the veneration versus worship line.
Exactly. And takeaway three links straight to theology. Art as a bridge between material and divine. This is grounded in the incarnational principle, the core Christian belief that God became human, became material in Jesus Christ.
Ah, so because God became physical, using physical things like art to connect with God makes sense theologically.
Precisely. It legitimizes art as a point of contact, not just a mere picture of something. And the fourth one, maybe. Democratic accessibility. We touched on this, but historically, art was crucial for making faith accessible. Visual theology for the illiterate majority. It let everyone participate, understand the stories, feel the emotions, regardless of education.
Those are really useful lenses. Williamson has some great lines in the book too, doesn't she?
Oh, definitely. She really crystallizes these ideas, like paraphrasing one of her core points. Asking what is Christian art is kind of the wrong question. We should ask when and how does art become Christian? And the answer is in its function, not its style. It really captures that dynamic definition.
Yeah, I like that. And the way she explains icons. The Byzantine icon wasn't meant to be a realistic portrait. It was a theological statement, a sacred threshold, a carefully made window to glimpse the divine. It cuts through so much modern confusion about icons just being primitive pictures.
Right. It highlights their spiritual job. And thinking bigger, architecturally, she says something like, the Gothic cathedral is maybe humanity's most successful attempt to build heaven on earth using architecture.
Wow. Because it wasn't just the building.
No, it was everything. The light streaming through stained glass, the soaring height, the sculpture. It was all engineered together to create this overwhelming, immersive spiritual feeling. A total program.
So how can we use this functional idea in real life? Like next time in a museum or an old church?
Well, instead of just trying to remember the artist's name or the date, you can ask different questions. Look at that huge altarpiece and think, okay, what ceremony happened right here? What was its job for the people who worshiped in this space?
It shifts it from just looking passively
to investigating actively, thinking about its purpose. And honestly, this way of thinking, prioritizing function and context over just inherent quality, you can apply that anywhere.
How so?
Well, think about how we decide anything is important or valuable culturally. A book, a song, a political idea. Often its significance comes less from its own features and more from how it's used, who uses it, and in what context. Williamson's approach is a good critical thinking tool generally.
That's a really good point. And maybe on a personal level.
Yeah, the book kind of validates the idea that art, or even just certain spaces or objects, can genuinely be tools for reflection or spiritual practice. Yeah. You could ask yourself, what places, what images, what objects in my life affect how I feel, how I think, how I connect with things?
Mm. Interesting. What was the biggest thing you took away, or maybe what surprised you most?
For me, I think it was the emphasis on meaning being co-created. It's not just inherent in the object. It emerges from how people use it, interpret it, relate to it over time. That statue isn't just marble, its function changes. It could be a focus for prayer one century, a target for iconoclasts the next, a museum piece later. Its job evolves.
Yeah, I really love that too. The idea that Christian art is defined by its relationship with people, it makes you, the viewer, feel more involved. Like you said, you see that crucifix or cathedral not just as some old artifact, but as an object with a job to do.
Exactly. Which leads to a final thought, maybe for you listening. If we take this functional definition seriously, what new things might count as Christian art today? Especially thinking about like the digital world. Are there websites, apps, online communities, digital images that are now trying to do those same traditional jobs, teaching the faith, helping personal devotion, creating a sense of connection to something bigger?
That is definitely something to think about. What does functional Christian art look like now? We'll leave you with that question to ponder. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acontra Foundation.